You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. It's the 8th of January, 2026, and this is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman in Flagstaff, bringing you news of interest to our veterans community here in Arizona. Today we have news from our military news websites, as well as the publications and websites of our veterans service organizations and the Veterans Administration. Starting off, we'll go to stripes.com. That's the official website of the Stars and Stripes newspaper. For this item, Hegseth censures Senator Mark Kelly, moves to review retirement rank after video urging troops to disobey unlawful orders. This article is by Matthew Adams of Stars and Stripes from the 5th of January, Washington. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Monday censured Senator Mark Kelly and moved to demote his military rank after telling troops in a video they could refuse unlawful orders. The Department of War and the American people expect justice, Hegseth posted on X. The Department of War is the secondary name for the Defense Department after President Donald Trump signed an executive order in September. In November, Kelly, a retired Navy captain, participated in a video alongside five other Democrat lawmakers who served in the military and intelligence community, urging service members to remember their oaths to the Constitution and disobey illegal orders. Kelly, Democrat of Arizona, retired from the Navy in 2011 and is a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee, which conducts congressional oversight of the Pentagon. The Pentagon launched a review at the time. In response to Kelly's seditious statements, Hegseth said the Pentagon initiated retirement grade proceedings, which could result in grade reduction and retirement pay. Hegseth also issued a formal letter of censure saying it is a necessary step and will be placed in Kelly's permanent military personnel file. Captain Kelly has been provided a notice of the basis for this action and has 30 days to submit a response. The retirement grade determination process directed by Secretary Hegseth will be completed within 45 days, Hegseth wrote. Captain Kelly's status as a sitting United States Senator does not exempt him from accountability, and further violations could result in further action. Hegseth added these actions are based on comments made by Kelly from June to December 2025, in which he characterized lawful military operations as illegal and counseled members of the armed forces to refuse lawful orders. Kelly responded on X by acknowledging he risked his life in more than 25 years of service, including 39 combat missions, to protect the country and defend the Constitution, including First Amendment rights. I never expected that the President of the United States and the Secretary of Defense would attack me for doing exactly that, Kelly said. Pete Hegseth wants to send a message to every single retired service member that if they say something he or Donald Trump doesn't like, they will come after them the same way. It's outrageous and it is wrong. I will fight this with everything I've got. Kelly appeared in the video alongside Senator Elissa Slotkin of Michigan, who previously worked as a CIA analyst, and Representatives Maggie Goodlander of New Hampshire, a former Navy reservist, Chrissy Houlihan of Pennsylvania, a former Air Force officer, Jason Crow of Colorado, a former Army Ranger, and Chris DeLucio of Pennsylvania, Navy veteran. In the video, Kelly addresses the military and intelligence community saying, like us, you swore an oath. He later states, our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders. At the time, the Pentagon came under scrutiny after September 2nd attack on a suspected drug boat in the Caribbean. Lawmakers called for investigations into the attack after news reports revealed the first strike had failed to destroy the boat and left two survivors clinging to the wreckage. The Republican chairman of the House and Senate Armed Services Committee in December said they were satisfied with the Pentagon's explanation and would not pursue any further congressional oversight of the episode. And that's Hegseth censures Senator Mark Kelly moves to review retirement rank after video urging troops to disobey unlawful orders. Our next article is by Linda F. Hershey. Iraq War Veteran Seeks Purple Heart Medal More Than 20 Years After Deployment. This from the 5th of January, Washington. An Iraq War veteran has petitioned the Army, claiming it failed to award him the Purple Heart for combat-related injuries suffered more than 20 years ago. The medal, which honors extraordinary service and sacrifice on the battlefield, also unlocks medical and financial benefits for recipients and their survivors. There's no statutory time limit for awarding the Purple Heart. Stephen J. Froom of Colorado, a former military police soldier, argues in a petition to the Army Review Board's agency that the military failed to consider his injuries and act to award him the Purple Heart in multiple instances. Purple Heart medals recognize service members seriously wounded or killed in enemy action. Froom's petition was submitted as a request to correct his military records. The award is usually a command responsibility, but the petition process is a path for correcting an omission. Veterans awarded Purple Hearts also may qualify for special monthly compensation added to their VA disability payments, depending on the severity of injuries. The enhanced payments are to help veterans with serious medical needs. Froom has a 100% disability rating from the Department of Veterans Affairs. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, two traumatic brain injuries that caused him to lose consciousness, a shrapnel wound, and other injuries, according to a petition for correction filed with Army Review Board's agency. But more than 20 years after deployment, Froom is still fighting to receive the recognition he rightly deserves, said Allison Weber, his attorney. This is about his effort to preserve his own legacy and to shed light on the contributions of other members of his unit. He's also seeking a Distinguished Service Cross or Silver Star for his service. The medals are the Army's second and third highest decorations for valor, respectively. This is about claiming my legacy. Money has never been a motivator for me, Froom said about his efforts for the formal recognition. I have these events that shaped my life, but no proof of them. Froom participated in missions to overthrow Saddam Hussein's government and to restore order to the country, according to the petition. He served with the 204th Military Police Company. Froom's injuries were related to an ambush, grenade attack, firefight, and car bombing while he was stationed in Iraq in 2003 and 2004, according to the petition. There is no formal count on the number of petitions retroactively filed seeking Purple Hearts, according to the National Purple Heart Hall of Honor. This request is made on the basis of error and injustice in that Specialist Froom was injured as a result of combat, Weber wrote in a letter that accompanied his petition. The Purple Heart is awarded automatically to service members wounded in combat or by specific hostile acts, according to the Army. Despite contemporaneous documentation and eyewitness accounts, the associated awards were never formally reviewed, Weber wrote. He has previously exhausted all administrative remedies available to him. The Purple Heart also helps recipients with their medical care, disability claims, and tuition assistance. Recipients receive priority status for processing disability claims, according to the VA. A Purple Heart medal may help qualify a veteran for special monthly compensation based on the seriousness of injuries, in addition to disability payments. The amount depends on the injury and impact on daily living. Examples of qualifying injuries include loss of a hand or limb, blindness, or being permanently bedridden and unable to perform routine functions such as bathing and dressing. A Purple Heart and its documentation serves as strong evidence that your injury occurred in combat, which is crucial for proving service connection for severe conditions that qualify for special monthly compensation or combat-related special compensation, according to the VA. Purple Heart recipients do not have co-payments on outpatient services and hospitalizations at the VA. They receive priority status in scheduling VA medical appointments. Recipients are granted full post-9/11 GI Bill education benefits regardless of time on active duty. They receive preferences for federal government job opportunities, too. Family members may also be eligible for health coverage, tuition assistance, and other benefits. Weber wrote that the high op tempo and various distractions during Froom's deployment led to oversight in recognizing him. Froom was a highly respected soldier and combat leader who regularly exposed himself to danger to further the mission and protect his fellow unit members, Weber wrote. If his petition fails, Froom has the option to challenge the decision. He can sue in federal district court if an appeal is denied. The Defense Department has not awarded Purple Hearts for PTSD because the condition is classified as a psychological illness, not a physical injury. Froom experienced extreme PTSD as a result of his deployment, according to the petition. He has had depression, painful memories, and mental instability. I do have PTSD, but do not feel it alone meets the standard for a Purple Heart, Froom said. But there's a growing pressure by veterans groups for the Defense Department to revisit Purple Heart eligibility, according to DisabledVeterans.org, an advocacy group founded by Benjamin Krause, an Air Force veteran and attorney. Veterans with combat-related PTSD may be denied certain honors because their injuries are not seen, Krause said. They often struggle to explain the depth of their trauma to a system that often only acknowledges physical harm, Krause said. That's Iraq War veteran seeks Purple Heart Medal more than 20 years after deployment. We'll turn now to militarytimes.com. And we have this item by Tanya Nouri. DoD launches review of effectiveness of women in ground combat roles. The Pentagon has launched a formal review of the effectiveness of women in ground combat positions nearly a decade after the Defense Department ended a ban that had excluded them from frontline infantry, armor, and artillery units. The 6 months assessment, first reported by NPR on Tuesday, will require Army and Marine leaders to submit data on readiness, training, performance, casualties, and climate and command climate of ground combat units and personnel, according to a December memo sent by Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel Anthony Tata. Pentagon officials cast the move as a way to gauge the operational effectiveness of ground combat units and examine how women have integrated into combat roles over the last 10 years. The Institute for Defense Analysis is reviewing the effectiveness of having women in ground combat roles to ensure standards are met and the United States maintains the most lethal military, Kingsley Wilson, the Pentagon press secretary, said in a statement to Military Times. The Institute is a private, nonprofit organization that's largely financed by the federal government to research and analyze national security issues for the Department of Defense. Our standards for combat arms positions will be elite, uniform, and sex neutral because the weight of a rucksack or a human being doesn't care if you're a man or a woman, Wilson added, noting that Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth will not compromise standards to satisfy quotas or an ideological agenda. This is common sense. Hegseth, who previously expressed opposition to women serving in ground combat roles, outlined new physical fitness standards for combat posts during an address to hundreds of military leaders in September. Pentagon chief said he's requiring every combat position to return to the highest male standard, while acknowledging if that means no women qualify for some combat jobs, so be it. I don't want my son serving alongside troops who are out of shape or in a combat unit with females who can't meet the same combat arms physical standards as men, Hegseth asserted. Standards must be uniform, gender neutral, and high. If not, they're not standards. They're just suggestions, suggestions that get our sons and daughters killed. Before he was nominated as Defense Secretary, Hegseth, speaking on Sean Ryan's podcast, bluntly said, "I'm straight up just saying we should not have women in combat roles. It hasn't made us more effective, hasn't made us more lethal, has made fighting more complicated." Asked about his views on women in the military during his confirmation hearing, Hegseth responded, Women will have access to ground combat roles given the standards remain high, and we will have a review to ensure the standards have not been eroded. Data released in 2023 showed that women accounted for 17.7% of active duty troops in the military. That's DoD launches review of effectiveness of women in ground combat roles. Next, from MilitaryTimes.com, we have State Veterans Cemeteries Receive Grants for Improvement and Expansion. This is by Christina Stasis from the 6th of January. Certain state veterans ceremonies across the country received a near total of $80 million in grants in fiscal 2025 for their improvement from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, officials recently announced. The department granted 20 state veterans cemeteries over $77 million in fiscal 2025 for their improvement, expansion, reimbursements, and the new establishment of one in Alaska, according to a VA statement released December the 30th. Under President Trump, VA is committed to ensuring America's veterans cemeteries have the resources they need to provide excellent memorial benefits and services to our nation's veterans and their families. And these grants underscore that fact, VA Secretary Doug Collins said in the release. The cemeteries awarded grants included cemeteries in Arizona, Arkansas, Kansas, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Montana, New Mexico, North Carolina, Tennessee, South Carolina, Texas, Virginia, and Wisconsin, as well as the establishment of the Interior Alaska Veterans Cemetery in Fairbanks. VA's National Cemetery Administration works to reimburse states for their state-run veterans ceremonies, cemeteries building, improvement, or expansion costs. The administered grants usually fund items such as improvements necessary for burials and operations and the construction of pre-placed crypts or columbaria, per the memo. In fiscal 2025, more than 43,705 veterans and eligible family members were interred in VA grant-funded cemeteries, making up roughly 25% of the 174,705 total annual interments in all national and VA grant-funded veterans ceremonies. The department has long strived to establish a veterans ceremony close to where almost every American veteran resides to improve burial options. Currently, just under 94% of veterans nationwide have reasonable access to one, meaning about 77 million veterans live within 75 miles of a national, state, or tribal veterans cemetery, according to the VA. Since 2023, VA officials have set the goal to 95%, but the task requires a mix of federal and local funding as well as a commitment from regional leaders for preservation of the cemeteries. The VA has awarded a total of over $1.1 billion in grants since 1980 to 124 veterans cemeteries in 47 states, 14 tribal nations, and 3 territories, working in tandem with the VA's 157 national cemeteries to provide more access for veterans. And that's State Veterans Cemeteries Receive Grants for Improvement and Expansion. Next, we have another item from Military Times by John Gutman. He turned down a trip home from the Korean War, then earned the Medal of Honor. This is from the 6th of January. On October 28, 1951, First Lieutenant Lloyd Burke was at his unit's command post looking at the ticket in his hand. His 13-month tour of duty in Korea was ending, and 2 miles to the rear, an airplane was waiting to fly him out. He'd soon be reunited with his wife and infant son back in Arkansas. That very same time, however, his unit, G Company, 2nd Battalion, 5th Cavalry Regiment, 1st Cavalry Division, was trying to advance across the Jiangkek River and assault Jeongdong, but things were not going well. For the past few days, Chinese soldiers dug in on Hill 200 and ground the company's progress to an exhausted halt. The lieutenant visited the 35 remaining troops of his platoon and recognized in their eyes the thousand-mile stare of broken men. Scooter Burke, as his men called him, had no requirement, in fact, no authorization, to push his luck any further. But he picked up some grenades and rejoined his men. Later, he explained, "I couldn't see leaving my guys up there without trying to do something." Born in Tichenor, Arkansas, on September 29, 1924, Burke dropped out of Henderson State College in 1943 to join the U.S. Army and served as a combat engineer in Italy, rising to sergeant when World War II ended. In 1946, he returned to Henderson State, where he graduated in 1950 as a member of Phi Sigma Epsilon Fraternity, Reserve Officer Training Corps, and his school's distinguished military graduate. When he returned to regular Army service in Korea, he was a commissioned second lieutenant. It was thus, as he was finishing his tour, that he plunged into his most unnecessary and most distinguished day of battle. Calling on his troops to a renewed effort on the hill, Burke obtained an M1 rifle and a grenade-throwing adapter and led an assault on three key enemy emplacements to what his citation called an exposed vantage point. There he led an assault on one of the emplacements, taking the center of the bunker and killing three of the enemy. As he charged the third enemy position, Chinese soldiers threw grenades at him, only to see him pick them up and hurl them back. Inspired by his example, his men overran another position but were then pinned down again, securing a 30-caliber Browning M1919 machine gun and three boxes of ammunition. Burke dashed over an open knoll, set his weapon up in an advantageous position, and killed 75 enemy troops. Although he himself was wounded in the fight, Burke retired only to obtain more ammo and return to his machine gun, with which he and his platoon wiped out two mortars and a machine gun position. Then, cradling the heavy M1919, he joined his men in securing the bunker complex, having killed another 25 Chinese in the process. Having played an unofficial role in reversing his platoon's fortunes, Burke returned home with a Silver Star. On April 11, 1952, however, he was called to Washington to receive an upgrade from President Harry Truman to the Medal of Honor. Continuing his Army career, Burke entered his third conflict as commander of 2nd Battalion, 16th Infantry, 1st Infantry Division in Vietnam, only to see the Viet Cong achieve what the Chinese could not. On July 22, 1965, his helicopter was shot down near Binh Hoa, and his injuries put him out of the war. After recovering, he was stationed in Germany and later served as the Army's liaison officer to the U.S. Congress. In 1978, Burke retired as a colonel with the Medal of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, and five Purple Hearts. Lloyd L. Burke died in Hot Springs, Arkansas on June 1, 1999, and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. And that's he turned down a trip home from the Korean War, then earned the Medal of Honor. The last item from Military Times is by John Gutman. During his 78th mission, this pilot came up against an unexpected foe. This is from the 7th of January. Even in its formative years during World War I, military aviators became aware that their worst enemy was anti-aircraft fire. And if one made it through that gauntlet, the next worst thing a pilot could do was return to his designated target where an aroused and ready enemy waited. In the case of Captain Merlin Diefelson, however, mission came first, even if it set him against all of the surface-to-air missiles, anti-aircraft artillery, and fighter planes the enemy could throw at him. The son of a farmer and schoolteacher, the Iowan graduated high school at age 16 in 1951 and joined the United States Air Force in 1954 as a cadet in Royal Iowa. After more than a decade in the Air Force, Diefelson received his first combat assignment in October 1966 as part of the aerial fight in the Vietnam War. Diefelson flew Republic F-105s in the 333rd Tactical Fighter Squadron and later the 354th Tactical Fighter Squadron of the 355th Tactical Fighter Wing, based at Tok Lee Royal Thai Air Force Base. The wing flew both single-seat Republic F-105D Thunder Chief fighter bombers and two-seater F-105Fs. The latter, nicknamed Wild Weasels, carried a weapons systems officer. That's not correct. It is an electronics, an EWO, electronic weapons officer, to seek and destroy Soviet-built SA-2 SAMs or the radar that controlled them. These Iron Hand SAM suppression missions, carried out at high speeds at low altitudes, had their own special dangers, made the more hazardous by the AAA and Mikoyan-Gurevich, or MiG, fighters that were coordinated with by North Vietnamese ground control interception. On March 10, 1967, Diefelson was flying his 78th combat mission, and his target was the area around the Thai Nguyen steel plant, a heavily defended industrial complex about 50 miles north of Hanoi in North Vietnam, according to the State Department. At the time, the plant was North Vietnam's first industrial center and produced 20% of its steel. Diefelson's WISO, EWO, Captain Kevin Mike Gilroy later commented that his pilot was a taciturn, born-again Christian and not at all the typical fighter pilot. In Diefelson's case, however, these traits proved right for the job. As the Americans, led by Major David Everson, with Captain Jose Luna as his WSO. I'd just like to stop and explain very quickly. WSO is a weapons systems officer and is a navigator with training in operating the systems on a fighter. And EWO, which is what Captain Luna was, is an electronic warfare officer and has additional training and specialization in understanding the electronic signals that are put out by the radars and other electronic equipment operated by the enemy so that they can detect and then destroy the surface-to-air missile sites and any aircraft sites using radar. As they neared Thai Nguyen, the defenses opened up, blackening out the sky with a curtain of 85mm AAA. The flight's number four man, Major Kenneth Holmes Bell, suffered major damage early on. Diefelson later reported on what followed. Both Mike Gilroy and I had seen some pretty intense flak in North Vietnam, but nothing to compare with this. The sky was literally black with flak, a greasy, deadly black. I lost sight of lead and all the smoke. Suddenly I saw Lincoln II, Captain William F. Hift, break to the right and heard the telltale shriek of a parachute beeper. Lincoln lead, Everson had been shot down, and Lincoln too wasn't in too good a shape either. By all the rules, I should have squirted off my missiles and gotten the hell out of there, but the strike force was still very vulnerable. I had fuel, missiles, bombs, and guns, and the job wasn't done yet. Diefelson flew a brief reconnaissance of the area. It really wasn't a matter of avoiding flak. That was impossible, he said. I had to find the least intensive area. The SAM site we were after was placed in close with several large 100mm anti-aircraft sites. Not guns, sites. Each site had multiple guns in it. Having lost contact with Bell, Diefelson set up a wagon wheel pattern of attack. I rolled in and began lining up on the SAM site for a shrike attack when something caught my eye, he said. How I picked out the MiGs and all that smoke and confusion, I don't know. I fired the shrike and broke to the right, just as the MiG launched a missile at me. More worried about MiGs or SAMs at that moment, Diefelson flew into the AAA instead. During his second run through it, however, he felt a slight bump. They were hit. Evading a second MiG's attack and sustaining another flak hit, Diefelson made a final strafing dive, firing off the last of his 20mm cannon ammunition before making for Tok Lee. Among other things, he destroyed 2 SAM sites and dodged 2 MiG missiles, helping the bombers carry out what was judged a successful mission. However, the mission cost Diflason his flight leader, Everson, and Luna, who were taken prisoner and endured 2,187 days of hardship and torture in the Hanoi Hilton, before their release on March 4, 1973. Bell and Hooft managed to bring back their battered F-105Ds. Unknown to the Americans at the time, the few MiGs they encountered were not North Vietnamese, but North Korean. Although the U.S. confirmed both, a post-war check of Vietnamese records revealed a unit called Group Z that fought alongside the North Vietnamese. On February 1, 1968, Diflason received the Medal of Honor from President Lyndon B. Johnson for his March 1967 exploits. Among the highlights of his subsequent career was service as an assistant director of Lockheed SR-71 Blackbirds at Beale Air Force Base, California, and director of operations for the Boeing B-52 wing at Dyess Air Force Base, Texas, before retiring as a colonel. He died in Tarrant County, Texas on December 14, 1987, and is buried in Arlington National Cemetery. And that's during his 78th mission, this pilot came up against an unexpected foe. The reason I read this to you is because I owe the fact that I came back from North Vietnam safely was because of the work of the Wild Weasels and their efforts to suppress the air defenses of North Vietnam. So my hat is off to all of those Wild Weasels, and they need to be remembered as the amazing warriors that they were. You're listening to Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to remind you that you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, including Weekly Reveille, by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website, either to listen to the stream or to listen to programs at a time of your choosing. That's available at the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app, which is available for your iPhone or iPad from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. You can always listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show. We'll turn now to the Military Officer Magazine. That's the magazine of the Military Officers Association of America. From their January issue, we have Mission Ready Nutrition, 3 proven real-world eating strategies for performance, longevity, and brain health. This article is by Lieutenant Colonel Nick Barringer, U.S. Army retired. In the uniformed services, we value clear guidance that works in the real world. Nutrition should be no different. Among today's most useful evidence-based approaches, 3 stand out for service members and retirees: Mediterranean diet, the MIND diet, and time-restricted eating. Here's a breakdown of how each works, including the keys for execution during busy days and travel, the pitfalls to avoid, and the results you can expect. The Mediterranean diet, a balanced baseline. What is it? A food pattern built around vegetables, fruits, legumes, whole grains, nuts, olive oil, herbs, spices, frequent seafood, moderate poultry and dairy, and limited red and processed meats. It's less about restriction and more about defaulting to preparing high-quality foods. Who's it for? Well, if you want a set-and-forget baseline that improves heart, metabolic, and brain health, and plays well with family meals and travel, this should be your default. Why do people like it? It's flexible, family-friendly, and easy to make work on the road or in the dining facility. Most people can run this eating plan for years without burnout. What's the impact? A randomized trial reanalysis published in 2018 by the New England Journal of Medicine found that among high-risk adults without cardiovascular disease, Assignment to a Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil or nuts reduce the incidence of major cardiovascular events compared to a control diet. The strengths: minimal rules and high variety, consistent improvements in lipids, blood pressure, and glycemic control. It's rich in polyphenols, omega-3s, and monounsaturated fats. The weaknesses: portion creep on calorie-dense, healthy fats, nuts and oils. Refined carbs can sneak in, so stick to truly whole grains and legumes. A sample day. Breakfast would be Greek yogurt, berries, walnuts, and a drizzle of honey. Lunch, grilled salmon salad with chickpeas and olive lemon dressing. Snack, apple and a handful of almonds. Dinner, grilled chicken, farro, and roasted vegetables. The Mind Diet, a sharpened focus on brain health. What is it? It's an acronym within an acronym. MIND stands for Mediterranean-Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. Intervention for Neurodegenerative Delay. The MIND diet is a hybrid of the two approaches with extra emphasis on brain-protective foods. Examples include leafy greens and other vegetables, berries, nuts, beans, whole grains, fish, and olive oil. Limit your intake of butter, cheeses, pastries, sweets, fried or fast food, and red meat. Who's it for? Anyone prioritizing cognitive longevity. And since it's so close to the Mediterranean diet, you don't have to overhaul your kitchen to run it. Why do people like it? It preserves the Mediterranean backbone, but provides a laser-focused prescription for cognitive resilience, a genuine edge for leaders who want to stay sharp into retirement. What's the impact? In a prospective study published in 2015 by the journal Alzheimer's and Dementia, higher adherence to the MIND diet was associated with a substantially lower incidence of Alzheimer's disease while participants were tracked in the study, even with moderate adherence. It's observational, not causal, but it's one of the foundational papers behind MIND. Strengths: practical food list and easy to implement in home kitchens and restaurants. Overlaps with Mediterranean. Benefits: lipid, insulin sensitivity, and inflammation. Clear, do more, do less guidance, that is, berries and greens take priority. Weaknesses: strict serving targets can feel prescriptive. Evidence base includes strong observational data, large, long, randomized, controlled trials are fewer to date, so keep expectations grounded. A sample day would include breakfast of a spinach omelet with herbs, plus a side of berries. Lunch, grilled fish and mixed green salad with beans, walnuts, and a drizzle of olive oil and vinegar. A snack would be veggies with hummus. Dinner, salmon, lentils, steamed broccoli, and a small side salad with berries. Time-restricted eating, a simple timing overlay. What is it? Known as TRE for short, this diet limits your daily eating to a consistent window. That is, for example, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Unlike intermittent fasting, TRE is the per-day version. No prescribed food list, just the clock as your rule of engagement. Who's it for? If you want clear guardrails without counting every calorie, if your schedule benefits from fewer eating occasions, then TRE is an easy win. Combine it with the Mediterranean or MIND diets for the best results. Why do people like it? It reduces decision fatigue, adds structure during busy schedules, and pairs seamlessly with Mediterranean and MIND foods. Many people naturally cut excess snacking and late-night calories. What's the impact? A controlled feeding crossover trial of early TRE, in which eating concluded by mid-afternoon in men with prediabetes, showed improved insulin sensitivity, blood pressure, and oxidative stress, even without weight loss. That's a powerful metabolic signal from timing alone. The results were published in 2018 by the journal Cell Metabolism. Strengths: it's operationally simple. For example, I eat from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Plays well with either Mediterranean or Mind patterns. Might improve cardiometabolic markers independent of weight loss, especially with earlier windows. Weaknesses: fewer meals can mean missing your daily protein target, so plan for about 25 to 40 grams per meal. High-intensity work might feel better with a pre- and or post-training meal inside your window. Very early windows, for example, 7 a.m. to 1 p.m., can conflict with family dinners, so pick a window you can repeat. A sample day from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. At 10 a.m., eggs sautéed with peppers and onions and berries. 1:30 p.m., grilled chicken and a salad with olive oil, nuts, and goat cheese. 5:30 p.m., beef sirloin, roasted Brussels sprouts, and a small baked potato with plain Greek yogurt. The right tool for the mission. If longevity and heart health are your goals, choose the Mediterranean diet as your base, given its strong, randomized, controlled trial-based evidence for primary cardiovascular benefits. If you're aiming for a caloric deficit, add a reasonable TRE window, 6 to 8 hours, to help with execution. If brain health is your priority, choose Mind or a Mediterranean plan with Mind and an emphasis on greens, berries, and beans. Observational evidence consistently links Mind adherence to lower Alzheimer's disease risk. If simplicity and structure are key, choose TRE as a timing overlay on top of your Mediterranean or Mind. Early day windows might deliver additional metabolic upside. Pitfalls and solutions. Under-eating protein. Aim to consume about 0.7 to 1 grams per pound of goal body weight if you're training and want to keep muscle. On TRE, plan protein for each eating occasion. Letting healthy fats run wild. Olive oil and nuts are excellent, but they're also calorie dense. Measure for a week to calibrate. Fiber failure. Fiber supports cardiometabolic and gut health. The Mediterranean and Mind diets make this easy. For those with tighter appetites, use TRE and be deliberate with vegetables, legumes, and berries. Ignoring labs. Significant shifts, even timing, warrant feedback. Track lipids, LDL-C, HDL-C, and triglycerides. ApoB, if available, fasting glucose, HbA1c, and blood pressure every 8 to 12 weeks during a new phase. All-or-nothing thinking. Periodize like training. Use stricter phases to hit goals in transition to a sustainable base, often Mediterranean with a larger TRE window. Field-tested execution tips. Default plate. Half non-starchy vegetables, a palm or two of protein, a thumb or two of healthy fats and smart carbohydrates as needed, whole grains, fruits, and potatoes. Go-bag foods, jerky, tuna packets, mixed nuts, and pre-cut vegetables and fruit. Travel 80-20, 8 solid meals out of 10, with 2 flex meals for pure enjoyment, social engagement, or when options are limited. Time carbs around training. If you include carbs, concentrate them before and after workouts for optimal performance without losing control elsewhere. Hydration and electrolytes. Early TRE or calorie shifts can alter fluid balance. Ensure adequate sodium, potassium, and magnesium levels unless medically contraindicated, and aim for at least 11.5 to 15.5 cups of water per day. The Mediterranean diet is your baseline. It has broad benefits, is easy to sustain, and at least one randomized control trial supports the theory that this diet helps prevent major cardiovascular events. Meanwhile, the mind diet sharpens the brain, and observational evidence links it with lower Alzheimer's disease risk. And finally, TRE is a timing tool that adds structure and can improve metabolic health, especially with earlier windows without altering your diet. Pick the strategy that matches your current goal. Execute it consistently. Monitor your feedback, performance, body composition, lab results, and how you feel, and adjust as needed. That's how you turn nutrition into an operational advantage now and for the long haul. Our author, Colonel Nick Berenger, U.S. Army retired, is a chief academic officer and dean of graduate studies at Lionel University. That article, Mission Ready Nutrition. Let's turn now to news from the Veterans Administration. And for that, we go to news.va.gov. And our first article is from the 7th of January by Stacy Rivera. She's a communications specialist at the Digital Health Office. Veterans find support within Inner World, a virtual safe environment. For veterans, leaving service can feel isolating. After spending years within a structured environment defined by shared purpose and camaraderie, transitioning to civilian life can be challenging. Finding a new sense of purpose and belonging is hard. In addition to these changes, some may also find themselves having to move geographically farther from friends and family, and they may find it hard to meet new people. With all these factors, veterans may not know where to turn for support beyond their traditional VA healthcare experiences. Inner World, a virtual peer support platform, offers veterans a community beyond the walls of VA healthcare facilities. Currently free for all veterans, Inner World provides anonymous support in a virtual environment. Designed by psychologists and experts, it fosters a sense of connection, community, and understanding. In 2024, VA collaborated with Inner World and 11 Veterans Affairs Healthcare Systems, or VAHCS, to provide virtual reality, or VR, headsets to veterans interested in connecting with other veterans in virtual reality. This rollout began a two-year evaluation of Inner World through the Peer Social Support Pilot, a lifeline in hard times. When help feels too far away and problems feel insurmountable, access to peers may make all the difference, especially if you can feel like you are side by side. For veteran Rod Dottie, September 2024 felt like one of those times. Dottie lost his home in western North Carolina to Hurricane Helene. Along with losing his home, he encountered several other challenges that resulted in a move to another state. Dottie learned about VA's collaboration with Inner World and began accessing it on his phone to attend meetings that addressed alcohol addiction and information about other sobriety offerings. At the end of 2024, a VA colleague told him there was a VR headset available and asked if he would like to experience peer social support in a new way. "I was excited because I've been interested in VR for a long time," said Dottie, who was more than willing to test the application on a headset. Dottie appreciated the way the headset immersed him even more in the environment and increased the interactivity. But even without the headsets, Dottie realized the value in being able to go into groups with knowledgeable facilitators or have a one-on-one chat with someone at 11 p.m. on a Saturday night. Virtual classes with real-world impacts. Accessible via mobile devices, tablets, and VR headsets, Inner World, a 24/7 on-demand platform, provides veterans the opportunity for social connection and guided events on a variety of topics, including trauma, loss, managing attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and much more. Since the platform is anonymous, veterans have a place where they may feel comfortable and safe to share struggles, maybe even for the first time. With more than 100 events happening each week, veterans have many opportunities to explore topics that may be most relatable to them. They can find comfort and encouragement in their experiences and then open connections in real life. These interactions are not only beneficial for veterans, but they can also be helpful for caregivers and loved ones. Safe, secure interactions. Inner World offers a variety of features that can assist veterans, including its accessibility and diverse options. Facilitators actively monitor events to ensure that veterans expressing words of harm receive guidance to additional resources. The platform guides can independently engage with a veteran, understand their situation, and direct them to the 988 number for the Veterans Crisis Line. VA Immersive. VA has deployed over 4,700 VR headsets across more than 170 VA medical centers and outpatient clinics in all 50 states, Puerto Rico, Guam, and American Samoa, with over 40 documented use cases and more than 10,000 veteran experiences to date. To learn more, you can visit VA Immersive, and that's at www.innovation.va.gov/hil/views/immersive/immersive.html, or you can just go to news.va.gov and search for health on the news.va.gov website. Next, we have 91.7% of veterans who use VA telehealth are satisfied. That's a pretty high number. This is from the 6th of January by Gwen McMillan, Communications Specialist, Digital Health Office. 2.9 million veterans used VA telehealth for part of their care in fiscal 2025. Every veteran's story is unique, and so are their health care needs. That's why more veterans are turning to VA telehealth. With secure and convenient virtual options, VA telehealth makes it easier than ever for veterans to access expert and familiar care. Take 81-year-old veteran Jim Smith. Making regular trips to VA facilities to get help managing his diabetes was no longer an easy option for him. Being able to use VA Video Connect, VA's secure video conferencing app, to meet virtually with his providers from home has been a definite benefit for him. The link to that is mobile.va.gov/app/va-video-connect. For me, being able to sit in my chair and get help instead of struggling to physically get to the appointment makes all the difference, he said. Or veteran Vincent DeMauro, who was diagnosed with Parkinsonism. DeMauro is unable to drive anymore due to his symptoms. His virtual appointments and use of remote patient monitoring devices save him from regular two-hour drives to the nearest VA facility. Telehealth saved my life, DeMauro said. It's pretty amazing how the whole telehealth team comes together. It reminds me sometimes of fantasy football. I feel like I have a dream team. Veterans across the country are increasingly choosing telehealth options as part of their VA care, and they choose it not only for its convenience, but because they trust it. In fact, in the last fiscal year alone, 91.7% of veterans who use telehealth reported that they were satisfied with the services they received, and 89.1% reported trusting it as part of their overall health care. More veterans than ever before are choosing VA telehealth. In fiscal 2025, more than 2.9 million veterans took part in over 14.6 million episodes of care through telehealth. This is a 10% increase from previous year. One of the most used VA technologies is VA Video Connect, which allows veterans and their caregivers to meet with providers from anywhere in the U.S. through video appointments. In FY25, more than 2.1 million veterans received care through more than 11.7 million video visits to home. The data shows that 92.9% of veterans were satisfied with those video telehealth visits, and 92.2% reported trusting telehealth after participating in virtual appointments. It's easy, convenient, and most importantly, it's private, shared one veteran who uses VA Video Connect to help manage his arthritis. VA Telehealth connects veterans to world-class healthcare and benefits. VA offers veterans with different options to engage with their healthcare services. There are 60-plus mobile apps designed for veterans to improve their health outside of a traditional clinical setting. And with My Health eVet on va.gov, veterans can manage their VA prescriptions, appointments, and medical records in the same place they manage their other VA benefits and services. Now, My Health eVet on va.gov is available at www.va.gov/health-care/manage-health. Veterans have diverse needs and preferences for engagement. Success is offering multiple high-quality options, be it through in-person care, mobile apps, telehealth, or secure messaging. So, VA is there for them when and how we're needed, said Dr. Kevin Galpin, Executive Director of VA Telehealth Services. Veterans can use VA telehealth to complement their in-person care. Telehealth helps VA deliver critical services to veterans, including mental health, primary, and cancer care. Veterans should speak with their VA provider to see whether telehealth is a good fit for their health care needs, and you can learn more about telehealth at VA at telehealth.va.gov. And that's 91.7% of veterans who use VA telehealth are satisfied. This is your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. I'd like to thank you for joining me for this week's edition of Weekly Reveille here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Remember, you can listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming either as it streams or at a time of your choosing by going to the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org, or by downloading the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. That's available for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store, or for your Apple phone or tablet, iPad, from the Apple App Store. And of course, you can always listen to Weekly Reveille and other Sun Sounds of Arizona programming as it streams on your Amazon Dot, Echo, or Show.